So Becky and I have been married a little over 17 and a half years now. And throughout the course of our marriage, we've learned something. I need to be the one that drives, period. It's not because she's a bad driver. In fact, she is a much better driver than me. So logically, it would actually make sense that she should be the one that drives. But time and time again, it's proven that when she drives, that means I have to sit in the passenger seat. And when I have to sit in the passenger seat, nobody in the car has a good time. And this was even proven, not like on purpose with me mentioning this story, but I think it was this last Friday night. Becky got to the car before I did, so she just naturally just jumped in the car, and then I sat down in the passenger seat. We barely made it out of the neighborhood. And she's like, I don't know why I drove, because I'm over there like pumping the invisible brake. You know how that works? Every time I see a stoplight, I'm like, do you see that it's red? It's red. It's red. You need to stop. Why aren't you stopping? Every time I see brake lights, it's, we need to slow down. You're speeding up. Why are we slowing down? And then like me starting to try to brake as best as I can. So we've just learned it's better if I drive because then I stay in control. And now that doesn't seem like that makes a, that's probably not a solution because the real issue is not her driving and the real solution is her not driving. The issue is me and I'm a control freak. I have control issues. And so the solution is, God, would you do a work in my heart? So before we jump into our study of James, I'm going to do something that's really good for me. I'm going to invite you to be part of this with me. So here's what I need you to do. If we can pull the lights up a little bit, you're going to need to see Bibles and stuff here in a second. If you can take your two fingers, everybody take your two fingers like this, all right? Find the side of your neck. Find a pulse. If you don't have a pulse, raise your hand. We'll send somebody over to you. All right, you feel that? All right, are you doing anything to make that happen? No, not at all. That is completely outside of your control. If it decided, if your heart decided to stop beating, is there anything you could do about it? Well, not this very second, no. We would send our medical team to you as quickly as possible. There's really not much you could do about it, right? That shows and proves there is so much outside of our control. So much more outside of our control than we would like to admit. We like to think that we are in control of our lives and even other people and other things. And the reality is, just by a simple check of your pulse, it's a reminder that I'm not really doing anything to make that work. And if it stopped working, that is outside of my control. And it points to there is a God that is in control of the entire universe. And it's not you. And it's not me. So throughout James's letter to the early church and these Christians that are being persecuted and spread throughout, he's reminding us of two parts, that the first part is most important, that we place our faith in Jesus, not in ourselves. We place our faith in Jesus, and because we've placed our faith in Jesus, we now live out our faith. Place your faith in Jesus, then live out your faith. And James has been writing, here's all these practical ways to live out your faith. And we've seen that through wisdom. We've seen that through how we navigate through temptations and trials and difficulties, how we live out our faith in regards to relationships and other people, through conflicts in the church, through living wise lives outside of this church building, through the words that we say. And today we'll see in remembering we live out our faith, and our faith is in Jesus, because we do not have control over our lives as much as we think. So if you have a Bible, James chapter 4, we started chapter 4 last week. We're going to finish chapter 4 and then go into chapter 5 today. If you don't have a Bible, we've got Bibles out in the lobby. Our gift to you, want to make sure that you've got a Bible you can read, mark up, and bring with you every week and throughout the week. James chapter 4, verse 13, follow along with me if you would. Here's what he says. Look here, pay attention. You who say, today or tomorrow, we are going to a certain town and we will stay there a year. We will do business there and make a profit. So two things real quick. One is that look here phrase. He's going to say that twice. He's going to say, pay attention. Hey, listen up. I've got something important to tell you. He's going to say that here. It's going to give a warning. Then he's going to do it again in chapter 5, and it's going to be another warning. So two warnings. Both times, James starts it with, look here, pay attention, listen up. So this first warning, notice the type of person he is describing or the type of person he is speaking to. It's anybody that is going to go to a certain place at a certain time, for a specific length of time, to do something specific for an intended purpose and to get something in return. That's all of us, right? He says, today or tomorrow, you're going to go to a certain town, stay there for a year, a certain amount of time. You're going to do something. You're going to do business there so that you get something in return. This is what we do on a macro level with our future. It's what we do on a micro level every single day. You've already done that. Today, I'm gonna go to church, and then I'm gonna do this, and then afterwards, we're gonna go do this so that we get this in return. Whether you think about your personal life, your family life, your work and business life, whether you're thinking of life within the community, within family, like we all do this. At this time, I'm gonna go to this place for this amount of time to do this thing so I get this in return. We do that all the time. We call this making plans. We plan. We plan what we're gonna do, when we're gonna do it, why we're gonna do it, and what we hope to get in return. We make plans. Now, there's nothing wrong with making plans. In fact, scripture, specifically even in Proverbs, speaks to the wisdom of making plans. But notice the warning that James is gonna give to all of us that make plans. Here's the warning, verse 14. So here's these people that go and make plans. He asks a rhetorical question in verse 14. That is the warning. Well, how do you know what your life will be like tomorrow? Your life is like the morning fog. It is here for a little while, and then it's gone. What you ought to say is, quote, if the Lord wants us to, we will live and do this or that. So do you hear the warning? He's saying, it's great that you're making plans. Again, James is not saying God is anti-planning. There is wisdom in making plans. What James is pointing to as the warning, though, is, yeah, but how are you making your plans? We all make plans. There's wisdom in plans. There's godliness in plans. But how are you making those plans? Because the reality, which is what he points to, the reality is that we all have limitations and we are not in control. That's the reality. So you make all these plans, but let me give you the truth, person making plans. He says, you don't even know what tomorrow's gonna look like. And in fact, your whole life is just like the morning fog. It's here for a moment and then it's gone the next. He's pointing out these two truths. You have limitations. You cannot see into tomorrow. None of us have the vision to see all that will happen tomorrow. We are limited in our view. We are limited in what we can understand. We're limited in our knowledge and what we know. We have limitations and we are not in control. We like to think that our plans are in our control, therefore what we plan is in our control. That's not true. We might be able to make some plans, but those plans are include a lot of things that are outside of our control. You can't control other people. You can't control what's gonna happen tomorrow. You cannot guarantee that your plans will actually work out the way that you want them to. So we are limited. We live in limitations, within limitations, and we are not in control. And what we see, James is actually echoing the wisdom from Proverbs. We see James do this a lot. He pulls wisdom from Proverbs and from the words of Jesus. And we're gonna see both of those today. James, like I said, looks at Proverbs. Look at it with me, Proverbs 27, verse 1. It's so similar. James is almost pulling this wisdom directly from Proverbs. We're told, don't brag about tomorrow. Why? Since you're limited, since you don't know what the day will bring. So yes, make plans, but realize your limitations. Sure, make wise, godly plans, but know that you're ultimately not in control. We have limitations, but God does not. We are not in control, but God is. Now, you could read this passage, your life is like a morning fog, here one moment and then gone the next. You could read that and be like, James, are you depressed? Are you just being a downer on the realities of life? No, not at all. He's giving us the truth. He's helping us be aware of the reality, which actually brings life, peace, and freedom. Here's what I mean by that. When we recognize that there is a God of the universe that is in control of the entire universe and is limitless, and it's not us, that actually gives us a sense of relief that it's not on our shoulders. Not only is there a God of the universe that is limitless and is in control, but we know him. He loves us and we have a loving relationship with him. We actually experience more freedom and peace living a life within the limits we were created to live within. It's when we start pushing against those limits, trying to take matters into our own hands, trying to have control in matters that we don't have control over, that's where we find ourselves stressed, worried, and frustrated, and overwhelmed. When we try to live beyond our limits and take matters into our hands that had no business being in our hands to begin with. Now, keep in mind, what James is saying here, we have to read this in context. So last week when we started going through all of chapter 4, the whole point of the early part to mid part of chapter 4 was all about humility, humbling ourselves before God. This is an extension of that. What we learned last week, that we are to humble ourselves before God. Humility says, God is God and I'm not, but I need him. I am not God, but I need him. That's the posture. That's what humility says. And so here, James is tying in humility to how we plan. Do we make plans just based on what I think and what I want and my knowledge and my understanding and what I want? Or am I making plans being humble before the Lord? God, I have plans, but what do you want? God, I'm going to make my plans, but what do you think is best? Do we make plans with just me in mind, or am I making my plans with humility before God, trusting him, placing my faith in him, because even though I have limits, he does not. Even though things are outside of my control, I have no control, God is ultimately in control. I mentioned Proverbs. Proverbs speaks a lot to planning, but then this other side of making plans with humility, because that's what James is pointing to. Yes, by all means, make plans, but with humility before God, recognizing he is God and we are not. Let me put these up on the screen. Here's how I want to kind of explain them. I'm not going to really read them. I'm almost going to interpret them on how I would apply them in my own life. So Proverbs chapter 3, verse 5 and 6. I'm going to trust God with all of me. We've been talking about surrendering our lives to the Lord. James started his entire letter with that. So because I've surrendered my entire life to the Lord, I'm not going to make decisions based on only my understanding because I am limited and I am not fully in control. Instead, what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna seek the will of God in all that I do. So I'm gonna make plans based on seeking his will and I'm gonna trust that he will show me which way to go. That's how we interpret that for our own personal lives. Proverbs 16, I most certainly can make my own plans. I'm welcome to, but I have to understand and remember that God is the one that actually gives the right answer because he knows what I do not know. I may be thinking I'm doing what's right in my own eyes, but God's paying attention to my motives. We've seen that a lot throughout the letter of James, that God looks at the heart. So what am I gonna do? I'm gonna commit my actions, every action to the Lord, and they will succeed, not because of me, they will succeed because he's the one leading me. And again, remember, our version and definition of success is probably different than the biblical definition of success. Go back to the last one, let me hit the last one real quick. Proverbs 16 says this, we can make our own plans, but the Lord determines our steps. In other words, yes, make plans. There's wisdom there. We've said that time and time again, but I'm gonna trust God to direct these, which means if I make my plans, I need to be willing to let God redirect my plans, right? It's not just always directing, it's also redirecting. Every single one of these passages is what James is pointing to. Make your plans, but with humility. Make your plans, but recognizing that you are not God. Make your plans, but know the reality that we are limited and we are not in control. God is not limited and he most certainly is in control. And that changes how we make our plans. If we don't do that, if we say, no, I'm gonna make this all about me, I'm gonna plan this, I'm gonna do this because I want this. If we make it about us, then here's the next part of the warning. Here's what happens if we don't make plans with humility and God in mind. Verse 16. Otherwise, so if you don't do that, otherwise you are boasting about your own pretentious plans and all such boasting is evil. Remember, it is a sin to know what you ought to do and then not do it. That phrase, pretentious plans, basically means you make plans thinking your way is best. Even the idea of pretentious kind of means arrogance. It's I am giving an inflated view, trying to impress others that I know what's best and I have more knowledge and understanding, I'm more skillful, I have more control than I really do. It's an inflated sense of ability. We might call that arrogance. What's interesting is what we saw in earlier in chapter 4 last week and what we see here, James is gonna connect the two. Last week we saw James give a warning to those with ambition. Remember, ambition is this strong driving force that moves you to succeed and achieve all costs, no matter what, you are going to win, even if it means hurting other people. That was last week about ambition. Now he brings up a danger and a warning regarding arrogance that says, I have an ability, an inflated ability, and so I'm gonna trust myself more than anything or anyone else at all costs, right? He says there's a problem with both of these, ambition and arrogance. What's the commonality between with ambition and arrogance? The self, self-reliance, self-centeredness, self-dependence. Ambition says, I will get this no matter what. Arrogance says, I know all of this and don't care what anybody else says. It all points back, ambition and arrogance come back to self-reliance rather than being dependent on God. That's the warning here. That's the concern that James is bringing up. And again, the solution is not don't plan. Again, God is not anti-planning. The solution is not, James uses this phrase, what you ought to say is if the Lord wants us to or if the Lord wills it. Is the solution just everything we say? Do we just walk around, well, if the Lord wills it, I'm going to go to lunch today. If the Lord wills it, then no, like that would be very cumbersome in our language and our conversation. That's not what James is pointing to. But he is pointing to the mindset and the heart posture. The solution is to pause long enough and recognize I'm not God. Again, we call that humility. So here's the question I would have us wrestle with in regards to all of our plans. Again, think of all the plans that you have coming up. We're going into the holiday season. You got Thanksgiving plans coming up. You got family plans, maybe some travel plans. Then you got holiday plans. Like, we have a lot of plans in the works. So how do you view and plan for tomorrow? And as you just begin to think, reflect, and pray through that question, do you notice it's all based on you? Well, I'm going to do this because I want to, and I need to do this because if I don't, like, do you hear all the I's in that? Versus, God, here's some of my plans. What do you want to do? God, here are my plans, and I'm going to humbly hold them before you and say, but you have control to do whatever you want with my plans. God, I'm going to make my plans. I think they're good, but I need you to speak wisdom to me. That's chapter one out of James. And God, I'm going to take steps of faith with these plans, but I also am humble enough to say, God, if you change these plans, man, I'll just keep following you. Right? That's a very different way to view and plan for tomorrow. Two other quick notes just on this. The first one, you've heard that phrase, live like you're dying. You know what I mean? Like, that's not a Christian phrase, but it fits here. James is kind of pointing to this. When we pause long enough to recognize our limitations and our lack of control, specifically in our limitations, like, our lives are limited. Our lives are like the morning fog, here one day and gone the next. When we recognize that, and we sit in our limitations when making plans for tomorrow, that should change our priorities. Because we get so busy just making plans, we stop to think, are these the right plans? Are these the right priorities? What's a priority is what we plan to do. And sometimes we lose sight of the priorities, what's truly a priority. And all of a sudden, that live like you're dying sinks in and it's, you know what, why am I doing all of this? That doesn't matter as much as this or these people or what God is leading me to here. So when we recognize our limitations, it begins to change our priorities. That's a good thing. When we sit in the lack of control, you know what we experience? Freedom. You experience peace. Go back to the story with Becky driving. I can have two postures with that. The freaked out control freak that's nervous while she's driving. Once I calm down, especially when we go on long trips and she drives for part of it, you know what I'm able to do that I couldn't do if I was driving? Take a nap, sleep, read a book. When you're not in the driver's seat, you will experience a different kind of rest. When you are trying to control the things that you have no business controlling, we said it, stressed, worried, anxious, overwhelmed. When you recognize that God's in control and you're not, you will experience a different kind of rest because of your relationship with the Lord. So how do you view and plan for tomorrow? Sit in that this week as you're making your plans, but with humility. Here's the second warning. Chapter 5, verse 1, James continues, look here, you rich people, weep and groan with anguish because of all the terrible troubles ahead of you. Let's talk through this one. Second warning, he starts it the exact same way, and it's a very similar structure. He says, pay attention, look here, listen up. And then he talks about a certain group of people. The first warning was a group of people that were going to go someplace to do something for a certain amount of time at a certain time to get something in return. That's all of us. Now he says, hey, look here, you rich people. Now that's not, all of us have a different definition of rich. So let me get us all on the same page. If you have something, you're rich. If God has given you something, now you might say, well, I'm not rich. I don't have as much as them. That's not the definition. It's not comparison. You might say, well, I just don't feel like I have enough. That's subjective. If you have been given something, that means you have something, which means you are rich in the eyes of God, right? And this is not just wealth financially. You can talk relationships, We can talk about a whole bunch of things that make us rich in the eyes of God. So he's talking to all of us. Now, James is going to focus in on the wealth side, because in our materialistic world, that tends to be where we think of. So he uses that as an example. So he's going to talk to all of us that have been given something. And he says, there's a warning here. Now, keep in mind, once again, just like God is not anti-planning, God is not against wealth. He is not against people with wealth. As we're going to see, the issue that comes up is what we do with our wealth. What do we do with what has been given to us? Let's see it. Verse 2, your wealth is rotting away and your fine clothes are moth-eaten rags. Your gold and silver are corroded. The very wealth you were counting on will eat away your flesh like fire. Great picture. This corroded treasure you have hoarded will testify against you on the day of judgment. A lot in there. Let me help you understand what it means so we don't get sidetracked by some of like the grotesque visuals here. Two phrases to lean in on. The first one, the very wealth you were counting on. Again, God does not have a problem with money. He doesn't have a problem with people with money. He has a problem with people placing their faith in money. Do you hear the difference? It's not wealth itself is the issue. It's not having wealth is the issue. It is when we place our faith in wealth, that's the issue. And that's the phrase that he uses here. The very wealth you were counting on. The very wealth you were counting on to provide for you. The very wealth you were counting on to give you safety and security. The very wealth you were counting on to elevate your status. The very wealth you were counting on for an easier, more comfortable life. The very wealth you were counting on. He says, that's the problem, that you are counting on the wealth and not God. And then he explains the real issue that that then leads to. That's the word hoarding. The very wealth you are counting on, and he's going to describe it. We'll come back to that. But this is the treasure that you have hoarded. God is not against savings. In fact, go back to Proverbs. A lot of wisdom in how we plan and how we save, but with humility, recognizing our limits, right? So God is not against saving. He's against hoarding. Hoarding would say, this is all mine and you can't touch it. This is all mine and I need more. And where does hoarding lead to? All consuming. I need more. I have to protect this. Nobody can touch it. I need to have more and more, 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 more. And it's never enough, is it? That's what verse 3 is pointing to. When he says, this wealth that you are counting on will eat away your flesh like fire. He's talking about how our wealth consumes us. So we count on it. We place our faith in the wealth. That's a problem. Now that wealth now consumes us. It's never enough. That's a problem. And it consumes us to the point where we hoard it. And I won't share it. And you can't touch it. And I will do anything to protect it and get more. That's a really big problem. So do you see what James is pointing to here? It's not wealth and it's not having wealth. It's our heart posture towards wealth. It's how we view it. It's how we use it, right? Our worldly possessions will not last. James makes that very clear. Our worldly possessions will not last, and they most certainly can consume us. And that's the progression he pointed to. We place our faith in our wealth. It's never enough. It consumes us. We hoard it, and we begin to make money the love of our lives. Let me focus in just for a moment. I want you to see this. When we said that our wealth, yes, it consumes us, but it also will disappear. Notice the tense that James uses. Past tense, present tense, future tense. Listen here. The very wealth you were counting on, or right before that, your wealth is rotting away, and your fine clothes are moth-eaten rags. Your gold and silver are corroded. He's not talking about something that might happen in the future, is he? He's saying, no, this is happening right now. In fact, it's already happened. It is happening. Your wealth is rotting away as we speak. The fine clothes are already, past tense, moth-eaten rags. The gold and silver that you've been hoarding and counting on is already corroded. So he's saying it's not gonna happen. It is and has happened. Therefore, we place our faith in Jesus, not in anything, not in anyone or anything else. We place our faith in him and only in him. That's his point. That's the warning. If you have something, we are all at risk. We are all tempted to place our faith in what we have, which then leads to this all-consuming mindset of it's not enough, which then leads to us hoarding, and then that becomes a heart problem. Jesus speaks of this as well. In fact, James almost used word for word Jesus's language here. Matthew chapter 6, this is what Jesus said in what we'd call the Sermon on the Mount. He said, don't store up There's the hoarding. That's hoarding language, so that it's all consuming. Don't store up treasures here on earth where moths eat them and rust destroys them, and where thieves break in and steal. Store your treasures in heaven, where moths and rust cannot destroy and thieves do not break in and steal. He sums it all up. Jesus explains, wherever your treasure is, there the desires of your heart will also be. Go down to verse 24. Jesus continues, no one can serve two masters, for you will hate one and love the other. You will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and be enslaved to money. This all points back to the heart. Ultimately, it's not about money and it's not about riches and it's not about what you have or don't have. James is pointing to it. Jesus says it plainly. It's about our heart. What's in our heart? It's about our heart posture. Our heart posture then points to what we value. What do we value? What does God value? Because the real problem is when we value something different than what God values. When we love something that is not what God is leading us to love. And Jesus says, and you can't love both money and God. If you're gonna have a love for money, then you will notice the love you have for God and others becomes less and less. We cannot serve both. That's been a big theme throughout James. This divided loyalty, this divided heart, but it is a heart problem. It is not a money problem. It always comes back to the heart. James explains this a little bit further and kind of paints a picture. He says, so here's the progression. He kind of sums up this money section. Verse 4, for listen, hear the cries of the field workers whom you have cheated, keyword, out of their pay, the cries of those who harvest your fields and have reached the ears of the Lord of heaven's armies. In other words, God cares about how we treat others and how we mistreat others. Verse 5, you've spent your years on earth in luxury, satisfying your every desire. You have fattened yourselves for the day of slaughter. You have condemned and killed innocent people who do not resist you. So he uses this image of a farmer that has a plot of land, that has all these workers working for him, and he seems to be productive, seems to work well. He becomes very profitable. But notice the progression. James uses this to explain and visualize the progression of what he's talking about here. So it starts out with, I mean, things are going well, but then what happens? It becomes not enough. I'm placing my faith in my wealth, which then leads me to be all-consuming. It's never enough, so now I'm hoarding. And then James uses this illustration to say, and here's what that does to other people. He uses the words cheats and kills. We cheat other people so we can get more. We kill others so that we can get more. When we place our faith in anything or anyone other than Jesus, this is where it leads. Right? It is a heart problem. It is a heart issue, not a money problem or a money issue. And all of this gets summed up so that you can satisfy your every desire. What's the word we'd use for that? Selfishness. Selfishness. I want what I want and I'm gonna do whatever I have to get it, keep it, and protect it and get a little bit more so that I can live this life of luxury, so that I can live a life of comfort, satisfying my every desires. Again, it comes back to our heart. But James really wants to drive home. That doesn't happen in isolation. That happens with how we treat other people. Thus the cheating and the killing language here. So let me say it this way, that we will either love people and use money, or we will love money and use people. If we love people, then we will use the money and the resources, what God has given us, we will use that for the good of God's kingdom and the good of others. If we love people, we will use what God has given us for others. If we love money, if we love wealth, if we just want more and more, then we will use people to get more money. We will hurt others so that we get what we want. We will cheat, lie, steal, kill so that we can get more of what we love. We can't do both. We can't do both, and James is pointing to what this will end towards. And it has to do with our heart. So let's ask another question. We asked this with the first warning. Let's ask it for the second warning. How do you view and use money? Is money where you find happiness and joy? Is that what gives you security and safety? Is that your plan? Like, the more I get, the better life will be. Do you use money for selfish desires? To live in luxury, to have comforts, to fill in the blank? Or do you view and use money recognizing that you are just a good steward, that you are a manager of what God has already given you? Do you use money to bless others because you've been blessed? How do you view and use money? Well, point to the condition of our heart. Verse 7, so he gives two warnings for those of us making plans, all of us, for those of us that have something, also all of us. There's two warnings associated, and both have to do with our hearts before God. Humble yourselves before the Lord. Verse 7, he kind of concludes this part. Two warnings. Now, here's what we do with it. And he changes his tone. You can just hear how he changes his tone in verse 7. Dear brothers and sisters, so take a breath. Warnings about our plans, warnings about our wealth. Dear brothers and sisters, be patient as you wait for the Lord's return. Consider the farmer, another farmer illustration here. Consider the farmers who patiently wait for the rains in the fall and in the spring. They eagerly look for the valuable harvest to ripen. You too must be patient. So take courage, for the coming of the Lord is near. Patience is his theme here. Be patient. You too must be patient. We've talked about this before. The word patient in the original language is two words shoved together. It's the word macrothumia. Macro, like a long time. Thumia has to do with heat or suffering. So a long time in the heat. A long time suffering. You put those words together, patience literally means long suffering. So he says, you will long suffer. How encouraging. But hear why this is actually encouraging. He's not being sarcastic. As you long suffer, remember you are limited, but God is not. You are not in control, but God is. And that God blesses you and takes care of you. And he uses this analogy, this metaphor of a farmer to give context. Notice how he's talked about farmers twice now. He talks about this greedy farmer that cheated and killed to live in luxury and to get more and more and more and more. Then he gives another picture of a farmer that is literally the opposite of this, a farmer that waits patiently for the Lord to provide. So let me just kind of pull apart the second farmer story metaphor just for a moment. Think with me, what does a farmer do? What is ultimately a farmer's job in regards to what they are in control of? A farmer plants the seeds. A farmer works the ground. And then a farmer patiently waits for the harvest. That's really, there's a lot of work involved. But that's really the essence of what's within the farmer's control. Planting seeds, working the soil, and then waiting for the harvest to then reap the harvest. Think with me, what is out of the farmer's control? What are the limitations of the farmer? Can the farmer make it rain? No. Can the farmer make the sun shine bright? No. Can the farmer make a seed burst into life? No. Can the farmer guarantee the seeds he planted will be an abundant harvest? No. Those are the limitations of the farmer. So therefore, what does the farmer do? What is required of the farmer? To trust the faithfulness of God, who makes it rain, who keeps the sun shining bright, who brings life and provides. That's what the farmer does. And you know what I love about this example? It doesn't take away the work of the farmer. It does take off the pressure of the farmer. There's a lot of work, but the pressure to make it rain is not on the farmer's shoulders. The pressure to make life come out of this seed is not on the farmer's shoulders. The pressure of having the sun shine is not on the farmer's shoulders. The farmer has a lot of work to do, but he lives within his limits. He recognizing what is and is out of his control, and he trusts the faithfulness of God to do the rest. That is a life of freedom, peace, and joy, friends. That is the life that Jesus came to give us and desires for us to live. And it's not all on the farmer, which means it's not all on you. It's not all on me. That's his point. From the planning to the wealth, it's not all on us. What do we do? What is our response? This, to be humble before God. He's God and I'm not. To submit under the authority of God because I know that he knows a whole lot more than I do. And so I'm going to trust that what he knows is what's best for me. So I'm going to submit under the authority of God. And I will surrender to the will of God, that he will lead me in the right direction with my plans, with provision. I surrender to his will. We humble ourselves before him. We submit under the authority of him because we trust him and we know he knows more than we do. And we surrender to his will, to the will of God. That's what's on, that's our response. Humble, submit, and surrender, and let God do the rest. Let me end in Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12, Jesus is going to give a parable also about a farmer. You can see where James gets his farmer language and farmer metaphors from Jesus. Here's what Jesus said, and he also gives a warning. Beware, guard against every kind of greed. Greed is more than money, by the way. Life is not measured by how much you own. Then Jesus told them a story. A rich man had a fertile farm that produced crops. He said to himself, "What should I do?" Man, what a great question for us to ask. God, I've got all these things I could do. What should I do? God, I've got what you've given me. What should I do with them? What a great question to ask. How we answer points to our heart. So what should I do? He asked. I don't have room for all my crops. Then he said, I know. Notice the eyes. I know. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. Then I'll have more room, room enough to store all my wheat and other goods. Then I'll sit back and say to myself, my friend, you have enough stored up for years. Now take it easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, you will die this very night. That's outside of your control. Then who will get everything you worked for? Yes, a person is a fool to store up earthly wealth, but not have a rich relationship with God. What does Jesus make this about? It's not about the plans and it's not about the money. What does he make this about? Our relationship with him. He says, you can make all these plans, you can have all this money, you can store all this up, but if you don't have a rich relationship with God, you're missing the whole point. And here's what's beautiful. When we have a rich, loving relationship with Jesus, then we make plans out of that relationship. We make plans and we say things like, God, here's my plans, but man, I'm gonna trust you. God, here's what I think I should do, but what do you think? It's because of that rich relationship with the Lord that we now make plans very differently. We prioritize differently. We find freedom differently because we are limited and he's not. We are not in control and he most certainly is. It's out of our rich relationship with him. In regards to our wealth, what we've been given, what we are managers and stewards of, what we do with that, how we view that, how we use what he's given us, comes out of a rich relationship with him. God, you've given me all of this so that I can then help others. You've blessed me so that I can be a blessing. You have been generous to me, so I will be generous. And that's not a have to. That's because of the relationship I have with him. It all comes down to a rich and loving relationship with Jesus. Because if God is a good and loving father, and if he is truly in control, and if he truly knows all things, and if he has no limits, then you know what? I can trust him. If God is a good and loving father, and if he knows what's best for me, then I can trust him. And I don't just trust him, I trust him with my life. I give him my life. That's surrender. That's placing your faith in Jesus. Because he is good and loving. And because he does know all, and he knows what's best for us. So therefore, we trust him. And when we trust him, do you know what you will find? Peace and freedom. We've said this before. This is the position that we think of with humility. We humble ourselves before the Lord. We make plans with humility. We have wealth with humility, always open-handed. And when we are open-handed before the Lord, the God of the universe who knows you and loves you, we receive peace and freedom from him. Not fear and control. Not worries and stresses. Keep reading through what Jesus teaches here in chapter 12. You'll see, therefore, don't worry because he's in control, not you. He is God and I am not. We trust the work of God through his one and only son, Jesus. We will never do enough. We can never do enough. The Christian life is not work harder, try better, do better, keep working. the Christian life is trusting the work of God through his one and only son, Jesus, on the cross. That his work is sufficient. What he did on the cross is sufficient for us. And he gives us grace, and we receive new life. And that new life is a life of peace and freedom. So may we humble ourselves before the Lord in all of our plans and all that we've been given, and receive a life of freedom and peace as we trust in him, not in other things, and most certainly not in ourselves. Let's pray. Jesus, we come before you and we thank you for your work, for your love, for your grace. Things we could not do, things we could never do. Thank you for taking that burden off of us. Thank you for doing what we could never do. So as we make plans and as we recognize what you have given us, may we first humble ourselves before you. May we submit under your authority and trust you. And may we surrender to your will as we follow you each and every day throughout the course of our lives. Teach us to trust you and follow you. And thank you for giving us not a life of fear, not a life of worry, not a life of being overwhelmed and stressed, but you have given us a life of peace and freedom, and may we walk in that life as we trust in you. In Jesus' name, amen.